Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, February 17th, 2022. This is the first edition of the AFP Report, a new podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Today I am joined by Don Jeffries, a researcher, author, and reporter for American Free Press, who has appeared on my personal podcast program, The Realist Report, previously. All right. Well, Don Jeffries, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Fine. Thanks for having me, John. It's been too long. We need to talk more often.
Yeah, I agree. I was actually just looking. The last time we spoke was December of 2020, so it's been over a year. It's definitely long overdue. There's never a shortage of topics to discuss. And, you know, you've been a writer for American Free Press for a few years now. I've been contributing to the newspaper since 2013. And I would encourage everybody, as always, to actually go out and subscribe to American Free Press. It really is America's last real newspaper.
Yes.
And, we're getting ready to publish the, I believe it's issue 9 and 10 of 2022. We're actually getting ready to publish that. It should go to the printer today and then be mailed out over the weekend. So, getting ready to just, you know, basically wrap up another edition. I wanted to start off by talking about the most recent edition, the most recently published issue 7 and 8. And you had a really sort of heartbreaking story that you published in there dealing with your brother. Apparently your brother passed away in the hospital. And as people are experiencing all across the country, it was really a nightmare with this whole COVID, you know, scamdemic, you know, ongoing. So can you kind of give us some of the background details and sort of explain kind of what led up to the situation with your brother and ultimately his death in the hospital?
Sure. I was, the year obviously started out very, on a sour note for me and, my brother, who I was very close to, much closer than my other siblings. And, he was my older brother, about 8.5 years, but I kind of was his caretaker. He didn't have anything physical wrong with him. That's the important thing to consider here. He was incredibly, incredibly healthy for a 73-year-old and, didn't have any comorbidities, didn't even have arthritis, nothing. You know, if anything, he was too thin, you know, kept kind of a Spartan diet, but, He had nothing wrong with him at all physically and mentally and emotionally. He had some, you know, little issues that you had to watch. But at any rate, January 6th, he called me and from the hospital. And I said, oh, geez. So I knew what had happened because until he started a new medication, his hypochondria caused him to call 911 and panic for really little things. And so he claimed he fell out of bed and he didn't remember anything about it at all, but he called 911 for it. And I said, oh, God. So I knew what that meant because he was in the hospital. I said, Ricky, I can't believe you did that because, you know, you're in the wrong place. So, you know, then he said, well, yeah, they gave me a COVID test. And I said, gee, I'm going to guess it was positive. And he said, well, yeah. And I said that. So I already was dreading it because I knew, I said, geez, he's in there now. And the hospital policy, like I think every hospital policy, because they all copy each other, is no visitors. So I couldn't go see him. And, you know, a couple people online were saying, you need to go down there and take him out. And I said, how? They have security. I can't, you know, I can't go. And then once they got their mitts on him, within a few days, you know, he wasn't really, he needed oxygen. And so he really couldn't breathe on his own. So I said, you know, this is awful. And, you know, I was only probably for only the first week or so, I was able to talk to him on the phone kind of, but, you know, he never knew what was going on. You know, he was always kind of out of it and confused about everything and concerned about what food he was going to be eating and stuff. So I talked to doctors and nurses. I was getting mixed signals. I never got the sense that he was going to die. And I told them early on, no remdesivir. Absent. Of course, they kind of, you know, questioned it because, you know, they obviously want to give it. But they didn't, as far as I know, they weren't giving it to him. So then on the 18th, because I was unable to talk to him after that, because every time I'd call, and first they moved in the ICU, and I was concerned about that, but they didn't have a room in there, or a phone in there, so I couldn't call him. And then the last few times I talked to him, he just kept saying, what, I can't hear you, and he couldn't because of the machines there. So it was very frustrating. I had no contact with him at all. And then on the 18th, they'd scheduled a Zoom for me with him, and you know, he didn't, I mean, he had that BPAP machine, because I told him no ventilator. So they put that BPAP breathing machine on. I was concerned he needed that, but he didn't seem, you know, like he was dying to me, although I wasn't really sure. He wasn't really paying that much attention to me, so I think he knew it was me. I'm not positive, but that was the 18th. Later that day, I talked to a doctor who told me that they had started giving him remdesivir on the 15th. And that happened to be just about the time, you know, that he was going to ICU and he was seemed to be going downhill. I don't think it's a coincidence. So I was, you know, irate about that. And, you know, the guy argued with me about it. And I said, you know, stop giving it to him now. He said, well, we were only going to give him four treatments. And that was the fourth. So I said, well, I didn't want any treatments for that because I knew what remdesivir does. And that was the 18th, the morning of the 20th. They told me that I could finally come see him because he was at the end of life stage. It's like, what? So, and again, that's how absurd these rules are. It's like mass regulations where you can't, because it's so deadly and it could be transmitted, but you can't go see him at all. But if he's dying, you can. So it made no sense.
Yeah, none of these regulations and guidelines make any sort of sense.
Yeah.
And wow, what an outrageous nightmare of a situation, really. So you specifically told this, you know, these doctors and these nurses not to give him remdesivir, and they still did that.
Yeah, they did. And well, the doctor told me, I can go where you say where you're going, you know, I can see where you're going, and I think you and I pretty much agree on politics. Well, no, we don't if you're giving him remdesivir. But he claimed my brother consented. And, you know, my brother didn't, I had tried to tell him about remdesivir on the phone earlier on in the hospital, and he kept saying, what? You know, he couldn't remember the name. And I said, write it down. I don't know if he did, but because I suspected maybe they might go behind my back and do that. Because again, there's no coincidence there's no visitors because they don't want families to see what's going on. And I don't think the phone situation was a real coincidence either because I couldn't keep on top of what was happening. And he, because of his issues, he was kind of out of it all the time. You know, he just was kind of, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but he was easy to confuse and it was always hard to gauge what was going on just by talking to him. And the doctors and nurses weren't, you know, they were sending me mixed signals. I mean, the couple of the nurses I talked to were upbeat and, you know, I get the idea he was going to die. He says, oh yeah, we can set up a Zoom for you again. And I said, okay. But so, you know, when he said he consented, I said, he didn't consent. I said, if he did, he doesn't know what he's consenting to. And I said, he would always, the first several times they called me, they'd say, well, your brother said to call you and ask you, because that's what he always did. But I had no legal things. There's nothing I can do legally. I didn't have power attorney. I didn't have anything written down that said, you know, all medical decisions have to be made by me. He just, you know, would usually let, you know, he would always let me do that for him. So it was horrible, you know, seeing that, spending 3 hours there and, you know, having to wear three masks and an Orwellian face shield and a patient gown and gloves. And it's just the whole situation when people are saying, were you angry that way? Well, at that point, I was just heartbroken. I was shattered because I knew he was going to die. And just watching him die basically was just a horrible experience. You know, we were there 3 hours and I told him I loved him, you know, I don't know how many times. And I don't know if he heard, but he never opened his eyes. He never showed any recognition. I could just sit there and watch his oxygen level go down and just think that, you know, 2 weeks ago, he was perfectly healthy. He had no symptoms at all. And then throwing another little, you know, conspiratorial wrench in the works here was the fact that when I was over there cleaning his apartment out with my wife, a neighbor came up to me and asked, you know, wanted to know what happened. I told him, he said, oh, that's terrible. He's such a nice guy. And he said, but, you know, I wonder what happened because he claimed there was a commotion like 2 or 3 in the morning, I guess, when my brother called the ambulance. And first he told me, the first time he told me that my brother was saying he didn't call and he didn't want to go. But then the second time I saw him again, he kind of changed the story, but it still was strange because he claimed he could hear the EMT people saying, you called us, you know, you need to go and stuff. So it sounded to me like they were trying to force him. And of course, my guess is, and I'm trying to get the phone records, which have not been easy to get, just to see if he actually did call 911. Now, if he didn't, you know, I don't know what that means, but it certainly throws something very strange into the mix here. But still waiting to try to get that. But my suspicion is he probably did call, and then he realized afterwards this is ridiculous because he had no injuries from the fall. You know, they checked him out at the hospital, so they should have let him go. And if he had a COVID test and no symptoms, okay, go home, quarantine for 2 weeks. But we know they're not doing that to other people as well, where they're keeping them just to be sure. And once they start the treatment, and that's what happened, my brother just went down steadily downhill. And that's the thing that just, you know, just irritates the hell out of me. Because my brother was 73 years old. I thought he'd live to be 100. He was not supposed to die. It's absolutely disgraceful. But, you know, you can't really point your finger at any one person and say you did it. It's the system.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's just what I was thinking of. Well, and, you know, I was already skeptical of modern medicine and the medical establishment in general prior to COVID. But I mean, since this whole rollout of this fake pandemic, the entire system has been totally delegitimized in my eyes anyways.
Yeah.
And it really is fundamentally part of the problem. And they're actively harming average Americans with these forced medical interventions. And that seems to be the common theme that you hear not only in your story, but, you know, stories all across the country where, you know, you go into the hospital and most people think, oh, you know, I'm going to go to the hospital to get better, to get, you know, to get, you know, some life-saving treatment, when in reality, you go to the hospital and your health deteriorates and you waste away and you get put in these situations where they're forcing these medical interventions on you that ultimately kill you, you know, in many cases anyways. You know, and I don't really know. I've heard the name remdesivir, you know, often in this whole, you know, since COVID has sort of been rolled out, but I don't really know much about it. Can you kind of explain what it is? I know it's some sort of medical procedure, or it's not even a procedure necessarily, is it?
No, it's a drug.
It's a drug that's administered. Yeah, go ahead.
I think they claim it's antiviral, but it certainly doesn't have the track record. Ivermectin, by the way, I have ivermectin at home here, and I had gotten it for just this purpose in case any loved one got, you know, whatever this is. And again, I don't think it's anything other than some, you know, some kind of natural coronavirus, which happens all the time, and it's part of the common cold, the flu. But I couldn't get it.
That's very much my experience, by the way. I'll just interject. I haven't been sick for a long time. I mean, this whole time, and I got sick about a month ago, in like mid I got sick in like mid January, and you know, typical flu. And I mean, when I get the flu, I will be bedridden, basically. You know, for a couple days, anyways, I will be very, very sick. You know, just like anybody, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know, I didn't go to the hospital. I didn't get tested. You know, I just laid around, tried to drink water. I didn't really have much of an appetite for a couple of days, so I wasn't really eating a whole lot. But you know, you get over it in about a week or so, at least the most severe symptoms. Anyways, it's still, in my case, it kind of lingered on for about 2 weeks or so until I finally kicked it. But that's typical. So they've basically weaponized the common flu, and turned it into this COVID-19.
Absolutely.
Disease, go ahead. I wanted you to get back to remdesivir. Yeah, well, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Remdesivir, and I've learned more about it since this happened. First of all, it's one of the typical, you know, just you go back to AZT and AIDS with Anthony Fauci, was in the middle of that as well, where, you know, that was a failed cancer drug. And, you know, for the cancer industry to reject something, you know how ineffective or, you know, it is. And they used that on AIDS, and it killed a lot of people. The same way remdesivir is killing even more people. But remdesivir is supposed to be an antiviral drug, and they give it to you intravenously. And that's why it's happening so much in the hospitals where, again, the families aren't there. And I don't think they're asking. I don't think they asked my brother. Even if they did, he wouldn't really know what was going on. And maybe they do that to a lot of patients. They don't know. Sure, you know, if it's going to help me. They don't know. The average person doesn't know that. And they put it in their IVs. And people, you know, began. We tried everything we could, but you know, over half the lab animals died when they were testing it. So it should have never been approved. It's absurd. But Fauci has a huge financial interest in it, and so does Donald Trump, his alleged enemy. And you'll notice when Trump had his fake COVID or whatever the hell he had, which was ridiculous. But you notice he came on and he disappointed conspiracy people everywhere because they all thought he was going to say, I took hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. No, he made sure to mention remdesivir, and he said it over and over again, remdesivir. And of course, you know, the stock was rising for both him and Fauci and lots of other important people as well. They have a huge financial interest in it. And the way it works, I still don't know. I mean, people are telling me that it's, you know, this hospital's making an incredible profit off of using remdesivir. They obviously must. But you do know that when somebody like my brother goes in there, they gave him a PCR test, which is a 90% false positive rate, absolutely meaningless. He had no symptoms. So when they told him he had COVID, he did, you know, he had nothing. He didn't even have a cold. Now, is it possible that if he had stayed at home? Well, first of all, he had never gone to the hospital, 100% chance. There's 100% no doubt in my mind he would be alive and well today. But maybe he would have gotten cold symptoms. I don't know. But he was a hypochondriac. So he probably still would have wanted to go to a hospital. I haven't looked at, because that's what he did. And I had a hard time holding him back. But, you know, if I could have gotten a hold of it enough time, I would have, you know, held him back. And, you know, I was sick at this. That helped. That affected this as well. I had not been sick in a long time. And, you know, I was, it wasn't bad, but, you know, I don't know. Did I have stupid COVID? To me, it was a cold. Wasn't that bad. It just lingered on. And Jeff Rentz, who I want to show every week, he was kind enough to send me Allison C, which really did a good job, you know, make. So if I could have gotten hold of my brother, I would have given him ivermectin, Allison C, made him take vitamins and stuff. And I think, you know, again, he would have been over it in a week or two at the most, like I was. But unfortunately, I couldn't, you know, get him. They got their hands on him. They're not about to give anything natural to any patient. They're going to give him their poisons. And once he got that COVID diagnosis, that hospital got $13,000 plus, which was what they get every time they give a COVID diagnosis. When he died, when they put COVID on the death certificate, they got another bonus. And I'm sure they got some huge bonus for giving him ivermectin. So it's very profitable for them. And again, it's not the doctors and nurses really who, you know, they're going along to get along and they have trust in the system. They think the system is great. So even though they're seeing people die all the time in front of them, they can attribute it to COVID. This COVID is awful. And that's what my family thinks, other than my son and my immediate family, my wife and daughter, my son, the rest of them. You know, I'm sure, you know, my sister alluded to something like that, saying he wasn't vaccinated and basically blamed me for him not being vaccinated. But they saw a 73-year-old guy. And I'm sure the first question they asked him, maybe when he got in the hospital, was probably, are you vaccinated? Once he said no, they fast-tracked him. And it was inevitable. He was going to get a positive COVID test. And I held off on the remdesivir for a while. But then, you know, I wasn't able to have constant contact, and they slipped it in there. So it's
– And you know what? They were probably I don't know this, obviously. I wasn't there. But I could imagine, you know, they're constantly badgering him and, you know, pushing him to accept this treatment, which seems, you know, using scare tactics.
Sure.
This is very common. This is how these people operate. And I mean, even before COVID, I mean, it's pretty, pretty well, it's a pretty well established fact, although it's not very well known, that the medical system really is one of the top killers in, you know, of Americans.
Third leading cause of death.
Misdiagnosis or medical error or, you know, unnecessary prescriptions of toxic and very dangerous drugs. You know, I mean, all these things. I'm convinced that the body has a way to naturally heal itself of any illness. There's no doubt about that. So, I mean, if COVID hasn't taught you to stay away from the medical system, nothing will. I mean, these people are just out to harm you and take all your money in the process, basically.
Absolutely. And if people are interested, they can go to my, you know, I write regularly for Substack, and they can go to donaldjeffries.media, and they can find my next to latest article, which has gotten more response than anything I've ever written. And that was online anyhow. And it's titled Losing My Brother, the Medical Industrial Complex. And I go over the entire story, and I also talk, because I worked for the medical industrial complex, mostly in IT, for my entire adult life, for 44 years, from the time I was in high school till they fired me 2018, almost 4 years ago now, for helping out a handicapped coworker. And it's honest, they wanted to get rid of the people that had been in there, and they were paying us too much money, and they looked, it's a right to work state, so they can do whatever they want, you know, it's a right to fire you for any reason. But and of course, I worked for the largest healthcare institution on the East Coast, Inova Health System, and he died in an Inova facility. And that's, you know, if you go to a hospital around here, you're going to go to an Inova facility pretty much guaranteed. So that just left an even worse taste in my mouth. And, you know, I write about the things I experienced like you. I had zero trust in them before this happened. And I talk about some of the things I witnessed. Working behind the scenes, you know, seeing the sausage being made. And I talk about what I witnessed with my parents, my sister, my niece that has Down syndrome, just horrific stories that you just wouldn't believe. And I was ready to believe the worst about them anyhow. But with COVID, they have a vested interest, and they're just naturally nobody. It's like any of the industries, like police. You know, you let police themselves, and you see what happens. They don't get rid of the all these horrible bad apples. Same thing with doctors and nurses. They don't police themselves. And, you know, there's a reason why when you go into surgery for anything, they use a magic marker to circle the area that's going to be operated on. Because for too many years, you had doctors, you know, cutting off the wrong arm. They did that. And when I first started working at one of the hospitals itself as a very young guy, there were stories all the time about, you know, surgeons leaving scalpels inside patients. They did this routinely. I mean, these are mistakes that a dishwasher shouldn't make. They do it all the time, and they're protected because people have the white coat fear and they have the white coat idolatry. And they bestow, you know, kind of a secular sainthood on these people. And it's disgraceful. It's because I can't think of a group that is less deserving of that than they are. For there are some good ones, but the vast majority are incredibly arrogant, have horrible bedside manners. They're very brusque. They'll tell you the most horrible things about what's happening to you or someone you love with, you know, little or no emotion. And they just, you know, and they make mistakes all the time, which they're never held accountable for. So it doesn't surprise me that this is happening under their control. But again, I don't think they're intentionally trying to kill anybody. And certainly the nurses aren't. But and they all fear for their jobs, too. If they protest, you see what happens to the outcast doctors and the nurses that have spoken out. So they trust their education. They trust the system. They trust that, well, we wouldn't be giving him remdesivir if it wouldn't help him. Then ivermectin's horse paste. You know, that's what they hear. That's what they believe. But it's a monster system, and they need to be held accountable. And I'm hoping that, in fact, I read, I think it's a doctor that a female doctor that is suing for basically the exact same thing happened to her husband. I think it was the same 2-week period. He went to the hospital 2 weeks. He was dead. Couldn't see him. So we'll see. I don't know if they'll get anywhere with that. But if there's any justice, and there really is no justice in America, but if there were, we would be looking at the largest class action lawsuit in the history of the world, because I don't even know if we can estimate how many people this has happened to. But the hospitals have really turned into killing fields.
Absolutely. Did you see that video that came out maybe 2 weeks ago now of the gentleman? He had gotten in a car accident.
Yes.
A young, healthy, you know, young guy. Yeah. He looked like maybe he was in his 40s. You know, looked like a pretty healthy guy, working guy. And he woke up in the hospital and he's got a ventilator on him and they're administering all these drugs.
Yeah.
And, you know, that he had been sedated, and he wakes up and he's like, what the hell is going on?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how often is that happening?
Yeah, exactly. And how many, you know, like, my brother, although, you know, because of his issues, or just kind of really easy to bully and easy to, you know, kind of, didn't argue, you know, he just wasn't a fighter. And so they probably had an easy time controlling him. But how many people are going in there that are his age or much older even that are out of it? Maybe have dementia. They don't know what's going on. They could do anything to them. And in the nursing homes that we saw, nobody can visit. So once they slap that COVID diagnosis on families, and unfortunately too many of these really older people, anyhow, the families don't care enough to visit, you know, because of American dysfunction. But the ones that do, they can't go see. So they don't know what's happening to their loved one. And they're certainly, they say, so, okay, we're going to give you remdesivir now. And, you know, you might as well say, okay, we're going to fly you to the moon. You know, they have no idea what they're saying. And so who knows how many times this is happening, or that they just don't tell them. And they put them in the IV, and they might have done that from the beginning if I hadn't mentioned it. I don't know. And,
right.
You know, and they could, for all I know, they could have done it from the beginning. I don't know how long remdesivir takes to kick in to start killing somebody. But so it's possible they could have just ignored me to begin with, because I wasn't there to see. I couldn't look at his charts, and I didn't find out till later. They said they started giving it to him on the 15th. But this is horrible that's happening, and they're not being held accountable. And again, the same mainstream media that worships the troops and worships cops and, you know, the celebrity culture, they're just not going to go there. Oh my God. I mean, how many commercials do you see that don't say, ask your doctor, tell your doctor, go? I mean, this is worship that we go on. They're trying to funnel everybody into that medical industrial complex and get them to take their poisons. And it's a real fight to try to combat that.
Right. Yeah. And sadly, most people just blindly and willingly go along with it. Just like we've seen millions of people willingly go take this totally untested, mysterious rush to market substance simply because, you know, they were told to by the government and by the media.
Yeah.
And now it's so bad with COVID. I mean, they're literally like forcing medical interventions on you, even to receive any, you know, treatment in general. I mean, you know, I think you can make a case that wearing a mask is a forced medical intervention. You got to wear a mask to go into a hospital or even to conduct business, to go into stores and stuff. You know, and this is something I've mentioned before. You know, if you read a lot of these local or state mandates, it's clearly stated right in there that if you have a medical condition that prevents you from wearing a mask, you're exempt. And yet if you go and try to invoke that at a store or a restaurant or wherever, you know, you're going to run into problems and you're probably going to get kicked out or have the cops called on you or something, even though it says right there in the actual legal language that you have an exemption. So it's really just created this totally tyrannical and dystopian situation. A good friend of mine, Jim Rizzoli, he's up in Massachusetts, and he was supposed to have an eye surgery, and they wanted him to take a COVID test in order to go get the treatment, and he wasn't sick, he didn't have any symptoms, he refused, and then therefore they refused to conduct a surgery. Now, how is this not like open discrimination, violating multiple U.S. laws? That's what kills me. Is like all, like if you go into a place of public accommodation, like a store or an office or, you know, city hall or whatever, and they're forcing you, demanding that you wear a mask in order to be in that facility, how is that not a violation of any number of federal and state laws?
Right.
Exactly. I mean, it clearly is, obviously, but, you know, I wish, gosh, I wish there was a way. I'm sure there is. I'm, you know, I'm definitely not a lawyer, but gosh, I want to just start filing, you know, like, I guess it would be like a civil rights or discrimination or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what it would be, but this is just outrageous what's going on anymore. And yeah, well, I mean, it has been from day one, really.
That is, but I think, you know, that I've always known that, that we, the people that are awake to the corruption and everything that's going on, we're outnumbered. But until this COVID narrative came, I never realized how badly we're outnumbered. And I look at my area again, the number of people wearing masks, you see them driving with a mask on by themselves. I mean, you know, insanity like that. The people that are just, you know, so don't want you coming too close. Now, I see it in my own family. You know, I can't see my sisters, you know, because they're kids, especially. I mean, there's a couple of them that are real Karens, and they're, you know, they don't, they, and this is horrible.
They totally buy into the whole narrative.
Absolutely. I people tell me, because I, you know, what I'm saying now, the kind of stuff I'm saying now, I was saying back as a young teenager in the 1970s. I mean, I was awake early on when I was working for, you know, Mark Lane's group, the Citizens Committee of Inquiry, as a volunteer, as a teenager. So I was awake to that part of it anyhow. And I started going down these rabbit holes pretty early. So I was constantly bad mouthing the system and talking about the corruption and how evil, questioning everything, including the hospitals back then. I was talking about what I was seeing. And, you know, my family kind of tolerated me, but obviously I didn't, you know, convert anyone at all. I mean, the only ones really awake in my family is my son, but nobody else is. And outside of my immediate sphere of influence, you know, my sisters and they're all their kids. I have a bunch of nieces and nephews, all my cousins. Obviously, none of them have been. And, you know, they basically have, a couple of them have canceled me, you know, because of this. And I think they really resent me talking about my brother being murdered, because to them, it's what the majority would think. In this case, of course, it's just as tragic to them. But in their mind, it's, you know, he had COVID, you know, he didn't get vaccinated. And that's it. That explains how you go from being completely healthy and dead in 2 weeks without dropping dead of a heart attack, without getting in an accident or murdered or whatever, or, you know, murdered other than the way he was in the hospital. But there's no, you know, logical explanation for it. But when you throw the COVID out, he had COVID. Then you believe anything. And that's, you know, so that's the way they're looking at it. So they don't want it, because their minds, like the minds of the general public at large, the sheeple, they're completely closed to this. Oh, you sound crazy. And that would be about the only response I would get. And they don't care about anything else. You know, don't you wonder how somebody can go from being completely healthy to dead in 2 weeks? And, you know, when I say there's no question of mine, he'd be alive today if he hadn't gone to the hospital. And nobody on earth should be able to say that. As you said, there are places where you're supposed to go to get better, but we know that's not the case. And, you're certainly not supposed to die because of their care. And that's what's happening. And the worst part is who do you sue? Because the doctors and nurses, they're not engaged in a conspiracy to, you know, purposefully kill people, but they're trusting in a system. The system itself knows it's killing people with this poison like remdesivir and the absolute death sentence of ventilators. That's killed so many old people. They know what they're doing and they're getting money for it. But, you know, how do you sue a conglomerate like the medical industrial complex? I don't know. I mean, I guess you'd start with Fauci, who certainly has a history going back to what he did and similar things back to, during the AIDS era.
Right. Well, sadly, I mean, most of these people are just simply untouchable. You know, they've gotten away with so much for so long.
Yeah.
And it's such an uphill battle. I mean, we know how corrupt the whole entire justice system is in general. So
right.
I think really the only answer is you just have to disengage from the system. You just have to, you know, you can't go to the hospital, certainly.
No.
I haven't been to a doctor in years. You know, I don't plan on going to a doctor anytime soon. I don't plan on, you know, purchasing health insurance. I mean, I want nothing to do with any of this.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you're right. That's a good way to approach it. It is. And I, of course, you know, I'm 65, so it's harder to do that, but I take tons of supplements, you know, and I feel good. I feel healthy, but you know, if I entered the hospital, you know, odds are if I told them I wasn't vaccinated, they would claim I was COVID positive. And, you know, if I'm not able to stop them from doing whatever they're, and I'd be obviously more of a fighter than my brother was, but still, I don't know. I mean, that guy was very lucky, that young guy that was in the accident, that they basically, you know, and see that, and that's more problematic because that does look like it's purposely trying. I guess in his case, they claimed he tested positive for COVID. I forget the details because I don't know how they could possibly, you know, rationalize doing what they did there. But luckily he was able, he's very fortunate because who knows how many other people, accident victims and so forth, that happened to, that were killed. And again, how many families questioned that stuff? I mean, first of all, they're like I was. And when I went there that morning, people said, did you get angry? Did you confront people? So who was I going to confront? A handful of nurses there and everything. I said, you know, there was one doctor that came in, you know, I was just brokenhearted. You know, I was just, you know, crestfallen. I was going through grief, and I knew what had happened to him, but I also knew that there was nobody there that, you know, that I would. It's like complaining to the fast food worker about McDonald's. You know, there's no point to it. So, but I'm fighting this the only way I can. You know, using the platforms I have to try to talk about it, and I'm getting feedback from people all over the world. So. I don't know, that are in the same situation, and hopefully they're not keeping quiet about it either. I don't know what we can do, but I think if it keeps up, and there's, you know, especially if it happens that, I said this about many things, but if it, same thing with the vaccines, but if someone that's really renowned or famous, if it happens to their loved one, then maybe it'll get more exposure because they, you know, they won't be able to sweep that under the rug. But, you know, I'm probably being optimistic there. I don't know.
Right. Well, it does appear, you know, looking at sort of some current events relating to COVID, it does appear that the system is certainly being discredited. I mean, it's come out there. In fact, the latest edition of American Free Press, the one that the article about your brother was published in, we had a front page story about that John Hopkins University study.
Mm-hmm.
That just totally destroyed the whole narrative of the lockdowns, how they were effective, and they, you know, mm-hmm. So basically, like, the whole lockdown situation, total failure, you know, totally based on bunk science and you know, ridiculous perspectives and narratives. Mm-hmm. It's coming out. It's becoming more and more mainstream that masks don't work. I mean, mm-hmm. masks haven't right. worked from day one, and it's been just like this absurd, ridiculous, degrading ritual that we're all supposed to just blindly go along with.
Yeah.
Vaccines don't work. I mean, they've had to admit that these vaccines are not preventing transmission of the disease. Think about it. Like, everybody's, like Justin Trudeau, for example, the guy has got, what, 3 or 4 vaccines, and he's still testing positive for COVID. So, I mean, even yeah. at like the elite level, it's becoming clear that these vaccines do not work. They're causing all sorts of major problems for people all around the world. It's really horrific. Some of the some of the, you know, negative side effects and other conditions that people have experienced as a result of the vaccines. So, I mean, in your view, like, is the system finally losing credibility with this whole COVID narrative and this agenda that's unfolded?
Well, there, you know, it's like people ask me that kind of question a lot, but yes, it is. But to people like us, though, the problem is, and that's why it's so sad that people like us. Well, I still have my YouTube account because I don't use it much, but you know, things like YouTube, Facebook with the fact checkers, I've lost a lot of influence on Facebook because, you know, I have the maximum 5,000 friends, but they shadow ban me, so they don't see my posts and everything. And if I post anything controversial. And a lot of people would ban completely, but because of that, we're not reaching the audience we have to reach. You know, we can keep preaching to the choir. Every show I go on, I'm preaching to the choir, basically. And that choir is more committed every day to trying to expose it, and they're more convinced every day. Like I said, they want to disengage from the system, and they understand how thoroughly corrupt it is. But the problem is the majority still said, you know, my family and some and most other people's families. They still buy into it, and they appear not to have any kind of tipping point or any kind of critical thinking in terms of how far. I mean, I'm convinced that if they told them, you know, you need to, you know, it's not enough to wear masks now. You know, you got a quadruple mask, and you got to wear a pointed purple hat on your head and pull your pants down halfway. I mean, I think that almost all of them would do that. At this point, they right. they're not
yeah,
questioning
it's pretty
anything.
Sad.
Yeah, it really is because they're – I mean, you know, when you're – I said early on with the restaurants, that situation, I said, you know, okay, so you're walking into a restaurant. You have to wear a mask to get in. But once you get to the table, you can take it off. I said, you know what? How – again, anybody that fails that test, okay, so the virus can't get you when you're at the table or the curfew. So the virus is deadly after midnight? I mean, it's just, you know, the people are just not thinking. And you see that when you have people that are, I see it all the time, driving around in their cars by themselves with their masks on. I would love to, but I don't want to confront these average people because, first of all, some of them are terrifying and the rest of them are just scared, you know, and they've swallowed the propaganda. But I would like to ask them, you know, what's the thought process here? Nobody's
right.
in the car. Nobody's in the car but you. So I don't understand why are you wearing a mask, but. And there's a large number of people that actually want to keep the masks on.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I don't think they –
They'll
yeah.
still wear them even if there's no mandate. Yeah.
Yeah,
you know what kills me is the people – you know, I see it at the gym that I go to. I haven't worn a mask for a very, very long time. The one time I did have to wear it was when I was in you know, traveling in the airport. And I basically put it on to go through TSA, and then I took it off. And I was literally the only one that I saw in the whole airport that didn't
yeah.
that didn't have a mask on the entire time they were there. You know, so I'd take it off, and when I get on the plane, I'll put it back on. And then I basically try to either eat or drink for the duration of the flight. So that way I don't have to wear it, you know. And I really haven't had too many problems. But, you know, you see stories of people getting, like, arrested and kicked off of flights for – taking down their mask for even, you know, a minute or two. It's crazy.
Yes.
It's totally insane. And I think it's you're right. I mean, I think most people just don't think about these things, but I think even more than that, the vast majority of people, I mean, like 90% of people just go along with whatever is being said, you know?
That's right. They trust the narrative, and that's what's happening in the hospitals and everywhere else. But, you know, I and there's so many great memes out there, and I try to share them. Again, I try to share them on Facebook, but they get shadow banned. Or Twitter, and you know, I think I'm shadow banned there too. But you know, there's a great one that came out at the Super Bowl, and I've tried to show this over and over again. Well, I'll share pictures of the leaders, whether it's Pelosi or Fauci or Gretchen Whitmer or Gavin Newsom or any of these people not wearing masks. I said, you know, this is if this was a real crisis, obviously they'd be scared too. They'd be taking it seriously. So if you saw the Super Bowl memes, it was a great montage of photographs of virtually everybody of any significance, from the NFL commissioner to LeBron James, all these people, nobody's wearing any masks at the Super Bowl. And I, you know, I just posted and said, you know, this, how many of these pictures do you have to see before you, if it dawns on you that they aren't taking it seriously? How many times do they have to tell you when they're not wearing a mask to wear a mask? And they literally have done that. I said, you know, it doesn't, you shouldn't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that. I said, they obviously don't believe it. Why are you? But, you know, it's
well,
just.
Well, and then these people will get up and make truly insulting and just, you know, in your face degrading statements like, oh, well, you know, when I wasn't wearing my mask, I was holding my breath. So yeah, that prevents, you know, the spread of COVID. And this guy, and this is the Jewish mayor of Los Angeles who made this statement, and he was totally dead serious. You know, as if like that's my excuse for not wearing the mask. You know, well, you know, it's fine because I was holding my breath. You know, these people are so insulting, and they just treat everybody like they were total idiots.
Yeah.
And you know, this has been going on from day one. I mean, how many stories? Think about like the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, when he's at that French restaurant back when this first started. And there are examples of mayors and governors and politicians all across the country breaking their own quote-unquote mandates and guidelines from the very beginning. So again, it's like, how insulting is this? I mean, how these people are treating you like a total slave and you're not even noticing? I mean, despite it's just like blatantly right in your face?
Yeah, and that's – I don't know what more you need to – it's the ultimate do as I say, not as I do. But again, that's – most Americans, I don't know most people, but certainly most Americans, that's all I can judge, have always, I mean, I remember, you know, again, it's a young, you know, just trying to point out, you know, why isn't the boss doing what he says? And they would excuse him by saying, do as I say, not as I do. And that was, and the sheeple back then would say, you know, do as I say, not as I do. Well, why don't you question it? But this gets at the heart of something I've talked about many times. And I think it's one of the many basic things that really it gets at the heart of why America, certainly, I don't know about the rest of the world, but why America is falling so fast. And that is that, you know, whether it's rules, laws, standards of conduct, they have to apply evenly to everyone. They have to apply equally to everyone or they mean nothing. And this is a perfect example. And this is a mandate. And first of all, what is it? I've pointed out many times. What does mandate even mean? There's nothing. That's not a legal mandate. That's like a decree from the king. This is, I mandate that all peasants, you know, that's basically what it is. It's nothing on that. I mean, all these things, where closing business, all that done, the government has no right to do any of that. But the problem is what happened? Not enough business owners stood up. And the ones that did, because there weren't enough of them, they were swatted down.
Yep.
They were prosecuted. And that's the way it is with everything, because not enough of us. And that's why I don't, you know, people have told me, why don't you go out? Look, you know, people like William Gein, who I love, he said, you know, like anti-immigrant things in D.C. That's not far from me. I'd like to go there, but I see what happens. He draws 25 people. And so I'm not going to go take a chance on getting shot or tased or arrested over that. If I know thousands or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, of course, I'll be right there. But that's the problem, is that now I'm glad I didn't go, you know, on January 6th. And I have, you know, not that, again, not that I was a Trump fan, but obviously there was incredible, fraud in that election, as in all elections. But I was in a dentist office at that time. So I have an alibi. But I'm glad I didn't, because, you know, people anywhere were subject to arrest. You didn't have to be anywhere near the Capitol. But I think, you know, people are scared in America, especially because you see protests all around the world, and certainly the Canadian truckers. That's a wonderful story. The whole world should be watching that. Maybe we'll get a win there. But in America, I think they were really cowed by what happened to the January 6th people and the fact that so many of them are still in prison. And again, the people that are wearing the mask, that believe this narrative, that don't believe in electoral fraud and all that, they are fine with people being in prison, having their constitutional rights trampled on, solitary confinement, beaten, for a year over nothing, over walking into a Capitol building, which is – how do you trespass inside a building you pay for? I mean, that's insane.
Trespass in a public building, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which they were – and it seems pretty clear in many cases they were let in by the very
– Exactly.
By the very officer. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it seems like and I wanted to kind of move on and talk about the Canadian trucker convoy. It's a topic AFP has been covering for you know, since it really kind of happened. I guess it's been the past couple issues, but this current issue that we're getting ready to publish, there's a few articles about it, and it seems like, I mean, based on Trudeau's recent invocation of the emergency powers, that he's basically declared martial law. and said that, you know, his government can do whatever they want to combat these quote unquote illegal protests. It almost seems like they're trying to turn this into like a Canadian version of January 6th.
Well, they are, but I think that what they're running up against, and that's why I'm really heartened by what I see in those Canadians. I mean, those hose heads up there, man, they're like, they're, I guess it's the climate or whatever, but they seem a lot tougher than Americans, which surprises me. But they are seem really dedicated. They're in it. The whole world seems to be watching it. And the fact that they're truckers and they got their big rigs, I think makes it a lot harder for them to deal with it. Just you have a whole crowd just kind of marching in. It's kind of easier. They're completely unarmed. But the truckers, and I think that, you know, the Canadian police especially up there know that these are tough guys, and they're not going to go willingly. So I hope they stand strong. And, you know, people say, you know, Trudeau he's being hurt. And the polls and everything up there indicate a level of support for the truckers that I think, unfortunately, if you see when it happens in America, I don't think you're going to get that level of support. I really don't. I think Americans, it's shocking, really, because Canada is, like, you know, kind of a socialist country. But clearly, they have more gumption than Americans do. I think Americans have bought this PSYOP more than any other group ever. And a part of that PSYOP is because the Canadians are obviously protesting the mandates. And most Americans seem okay with it. These are the same ones that are wearing their masks. We'll see what happens here. But I have an idea when they start their convoy. And I think it was a mistake in America to say we're starting on a particular day because that gives them more time to prepare. But Biden has already talked about Homeland Security. And I think you'll really see a militarized response on the part of our police. And unfortunately, I don't think you'll see that many Americans protesting because, you know, how many protested what happened to the January 6th protesters? How many people are protesting the political prisoners that are still there and the treatment? No one. I mean, very few people. And so I don't, but I hope that Trudeau has to back down. And but I don't know, man, if they're not used to losing. So the people don't win very often. So it'd be shocking if they do win.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's pretty revealing. I mean, these tyrants like Trudeau and even Biden and, you know, pretty much every other World Economic Forum groomed, you know, political leader across the entire Western world. These people are total tyrants, and they've basically had to resort to full-on tyranny and threats and massive pressure via the media to enforce this agenda. I mean, think about Biden's comments last fall where he's, you know, basically saying, look, you know, our patience is running up with you unvaccinated Americans.
Yes.
You know, it's like, who is taking this seriously? There, I mean, of course, there are people, but it's almost like – and I was listening to just some basic interviews with people participating in the convoy protest, and most of these people are just like not taking anything Trudeau is saying seriously. You know, these threats are falling on deaf ears, and people just don't care. And they know their rights, and they know that what they're doing is totally legal. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. I don't know what to think about the convoy that's sort of organizing here in America. From what I understand, I haven't read too much about it, but from what I was sort of gleaming from some of the social media posts I saw about it, the plan is to ultimately be in D.C. in early March for Biden's State of the Union address. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're supposed to start in California earlier that month. And I don't know. I think they're supposed to start, I think, in California to get to D.C., I think. But, I don't know. We'll see. America may not, you know, be socialist in name like Canada is, but the government apparatus here, man, I think they're much quicker to clap down on people.
Definitely in the aftermath of January 6th, you know, anything going on in D.C. is going to be taken very, very seriously by these people. And, you know, of course, the media is going to play right along with it, and it's going to be a huge coordinated effort to demonize anybody that's protesting and to bring the full force of the entire justice system down upon them, which is what we see with January 6th. And I wanted to talk about that because you have an interesting article appearing in this current edition of American Free Press. And you're basically talking about how Pelosi and the Democrats have essentially politicized and weaponized the Capitol Police to go after their political enemies and their critics.
Yeah, absolutely. And they, you know, we have a couple of the congressmen that talked about the one guy, I got Troy, I got his name now. Is it Vares? I just wrote the article. I said, no, should I deal with so many games.
I think his name is Troy Niels.
Niels, yeah. Troy Niels, yeah. You know, he's alleging that a Capitol Police officer went to his office and stole some files, some confidential files, and or photographed some confidential files. And so, you know, this is very disturbing. And, of course, the head of the Capitol Police is just kind of dismissing it again because everyone is politicized, and the Capitol Police certainly has become politicized. I mean, we know when you have a situation like the shooting of Ashley Babbitt by, you know, it was unarmed by a cop who had a very, sorry track record, including, you know, leaving his gun in a bathroom. You know, I don't know how he was still a cop after that, being that irresponsible. But nothing. I mean, he was given a stand, you know, cheers in the Capitol. And again, the Republicucks were right there, too, except for, you know, a handful of them that are questioning this, you know, like the four, including Louie Gohmert, who was one of the other about who has, you know, talked about getting mail that has obviously been opened. And, you know, so this is by the government. This is disturbing stuff. But we saw how they treated these guys, Gohmert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Matt Gaetz. And I forget the other one, but, you know, certainly Greene has been smeared and attacked. Matt Gaetz is under some kind of, you know, alleged investigation for an underage girl. So they're under assault by the media, but they're the only four that they tried to go to D.C. Prison to try to just to investigate firsthand the conditions because, you know, they'd heard about how these people are being treated. And the prison officials, again, these are congressional representatives. They just turned their back on them, locked them out. They wouldn't even let them in, and no media coverage. Even Tucker Carlson didn't cover that. I was kind of surprised, but that's shocking. And that's the only time our representatives have tried to do anything about it. Tucker Carlson has had other stories about it, but you know, this is amazing to me. So I think, unfortunately, if we did have a convoy here in the United States, and if they did crack down on them unreasonably and unconstitutionally, like they did with the January 6th protesters, you know, I don't know what would a poll show. If you took a poll in America about the January 6th insurrectionists, unfortunately, I have a feeling we'd be in the minority. Now, in Canada, obviously, that's not the case with the truckers. And again, it shows me maybe Canadians overall are more skeptical of authority, but Americans have just the majority. And I see it in my own family and friends. I mean, they've just bought into the biggest BS, and they don't have any filter. They don't have it's unlimited capacity for believing the lies. I mean, they can be told.
It shows the power of the media. I mean, the mass media has been so dishonest in its coverage of January 6th. And I think, you know, I think a pretty good case could be made that the entire situation was a setup designed to create this media spectacle to run with this narrative. I mean, I think most of the people there that were involved, at least from what I've read and from what I've heard from people that were actually there, they were very genuine and honest, you know, patriots that were, you know, standing up for what they believed in and protesting a clearly illegitimate and fraudulent election. But the, you know, the circumstances were sort of created and manufactured before the event. You know, it was a setup. It was essentially a setup, and the media ran with it perfectly. And people just trust what the media says, despite how obvious it is that they clearly have an agenda. They're clearly being dishonest, and it's really outrageous. This whole January 6th committee in general is really a pretty terrifying precedent that they're setting. Yeah, I mean, they're essentially claiming that they are totally above the law, that this committee can do whatever it wants in its quote-unquote pursuit of the truth about January 6th. Glenn Greenwald has been covering this very, very well.
Yes.
And it's amazing. I mean, and this guy's a lawyer. He's been writing about these issues for a very long time. And the way he expresses it and explains it is very powerful, and it gets right to the heart of the matter. And, I mean, this committee is claiming absolutely – like virtually absolute powers that not even the FBI or any other law enforcement agencies have.
Right.
You know, they're basically saying that there's no limits on what they can do to gather information and to subpoena people and to, you know, basically haul these people up in front of this like inquisition, essentially.
Yeah.
And I
agree. And, again, I think Trump, you know, is at the heart of this again. I call it the Trumpenstein Project. You know, I think he was an actor. I think he was inserted into the politics to divide the country, and he's divided the country like we've never seen before. And I think if you took Trump out of the equation even if this was like a pro-life rally or some other right-wing thing, I think you wouldn't have the, you would have more liberals concerned about what's happening to the prisoners' rights being violated, and it's unconstitutional, you know, just to be locking them up without bail and certainly beating them in solitary confinement. These are nonviolent people that, if they're guilty of anything, would be a, you know, petty misdemeanor. But you don't see that. You don't see the ACLU and all these other people talking about it, because Trump derangement syndrome is a real thing. And it has lots of my friends. It's a lot of people that I'd still agree with me on a lot of stuff. I'll see their post about the insurrectionists. And, yeah, you know, and it's like, you know, they need to be held accountable. It's like, what, you know, and you can't reason with them. But I think that if you took Trump out of the equation, they would not feel that way. But Trump has you know, triggered something. And I said, that's why I think I call it the Trumpenstein Project. He triggered something. And of course, on the other side, he's still triggering a cult that no matter how many times he doesn't do what he says he's going to do. And two more weeks, you know, the QAnon stuff. So unfortunately, that's where we are. And I think, you know, people need to get they need to look past Trump. I mean, whatever those people are in jail for, it's absurd, and they need to ask the basic questions, which I have done. Very few people have, and that is, you know, I've tried to look into whether or not, you know, first of all, was the Capitol building was generally not locked to the public? It makes no sense. Why would they have been enclosed to the public? Now, supposedly they did it for emergency provisions that day, which, you know, again, that's makes little sense too. But as you noted, we see the police. We have video of the police waving them in. Now, if this was such a grave offense, and they were doing an investigation, they would use that video and they would try to identify those police officers and ask them, why were you waving people inside? But of course, we know they're not going to do it. Instead, they pretend the video doesn't exist. And I think it's, I don't know how many hours, 1,000 hours or some absurd amount of video footage that is being withheld. And they're not letting the public see it. And it will tell the entire story. It'll tell what really happened with Ashley Babbitt. It will show how many people were really violent. And it'll identify the few that were, like the guy that Tucker Carlson is concentrating on. I forget his name, Ray something. He was an obvious undercover agent that kept trying to urge people to go inside the Capitol. And they're not prosecuting him. He's on video urging it. And you even have the rest of the crowd going, you know, Fed, or whatever, because they knew he was a government, an agent. Most people weren't listening to him. They're not targeting that. They're not targeting the people who they have, you know, they can identify and film the people that, the few people that broke a couple windows or whatever. That's the only act of violence that really happened. They can find these things. They're not prosecuting any of these people. Instead, they're prosecuting people like the former cop, female cop who was arrested on weapons charges, I believe, and she was armed with a tambourine. And that's the kind of things that's happening. And it's amazing. And I'm a civil libertarian. I came from the left, and I just am shocked that there are no civil libertarians saying this is absurd. I mean, these people have already been in prison for way longer than anybody should be for anything that happened that day. And yet people, I have people that say they should be hanged for insurrection. It's shocking. I don't know how you can't reason with them. And that's the problem. Trump did irreparable damage. And it wasn't because just him, he was inserted in there to do that. And I don't know that we'll ever get over that, because he's at the heart of the division over COVID as well, because it basically lines up on, you know, most, not completely, but most of the people that are trusting this narrative completely and wearing their masks have Trump derangement syndrome. So he's, even though, again, he's bragging about the vaccine and saying, you know, I take your vaccines and everything, but his cult still, you know, worships him as well. So again, it's the Trump division that's there. And I know I'm in a real minority with that. I call myself part of the smallest minority in the world, the Trump agnostics, but people want to go one way or the other with the guy. And I've said many times, people hate Trump for things he never did, and people love Trump for things he never did.
Right. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you got a really good take on Trump. And I mean, it's clear, you know, when he was first getting involved in the campaign, he had a lot of potential. Certainly when he was elected, he had a lot of potential to change things and really set the course. But, you know, of course, that just did not happen. Yep. And I think it's pretty clear at this point that, yeah, he was part of this establishment. And he was sort of pretending to be like an outsider. So yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. There's one last topic I wanted to bring up before we wrap up here, and that is you put together a really interesting article in this edition of American Free Press, kind of commenting and highlighting a very revealing exchange between a State Department spokesman named Ned Price, who's always in the media. You know, he's like one of the top State Department spokesmen. Mm-hmm. And he had an exchange with a journalist named Matt Lee of the Associated Press.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was all over social media. I thought it was fascinating. And Ned Price is up there basically claiming, without providing any evidence, without citing anything except for his own self, basically. That's essentially what he said. He's claiming that Russia is prepared or has plans to launch a false flag attack. And he used that word, false flag attack, against mm-hmm. Ukraine, using fake video footage and fake images and even crisis actors.
Yeah.
He literally said crisis actors. Now, Don, isn't this like the realm of quote unquote conspiracy theorists? And we have a State Department spokesman invoking these concepts. I mean, what is going on here? Yeah.
Well, that's what Matt Lee even said, this Alex Jones stuff. But yeah, and they've certainly smeared and discredited people. But, you know, I don't shy away from anything. I mean, I don't care. I'm, you know, and I know American Free Press and lots of other outlets in the conspiracy friendly press don't want to go there with Sandy Hook. And Alex Jones famously made a ridiculous apology for Sandy Hook. But, you know, there's nothing sacrosanct about that. It's like the Holocaust or anything else. I mean, Sandy, you have to question everything. It should be illegal to question everything. You know, the facts are what they are. And crisis actors exist. And as I tell people in the article, you know, and people can read my book, Bullyocracy. It's full of these examples because I kind of tie it into what's happening in the schools. It has nothing to do with education. And again, this was before the COVID narrative hit, which there's even more stuff obviously happening in the schools that has nothing to do with education. But at that time, and Alex Jones, you know, was one of the first ones to focus on this. And I had no idea this was happening. It didn't happen to my kids' school when they were in school, or I would have really been right there protesting it. But they're having these scripted events. You know, the same kind of thing, the crazy conspiracies people claim about Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing and all the other school shootings. These are scripted, and they're politically correct scripts. So they have live shooter drills, and the live shooter is a crisis actor that they hire. And he's always, you know, appropriate for the job. Go be someone who's a demented homeschool parent, a gun nut, you know,
or like a right wing extremist or something.
Right, you know, right. Yeah. They're always from the right. It's never, you know, a transgender that's confused about their 57 genders or a climate change nut or anything like that. It's always that, and sometimes the school officials get involved and they play roles. But they hire crisis actors. They have fake victims. And the most hideous thing about it, going beyond the thing, is that what is this doing psychologically to kids? And some of these drills take place in very young. And I talk of Bullyocracy, about the reaction on part of some of these kids. You talk about being traumatized. You think this is a live shooter? You think you could be shot? And it's just play? This is sickening, sickening abuse. And they see blood because, again, same kind of thing that people allege in the Boston bombing and some of the other things, stage blood. They use stage blood in these productions, and they are productions, and the police and the EMTs, they're involved many times. They arrive, so, of course, it looks really real, and sometimes they don't even notify the teachers. So this is happening and has happened many times, and I can give establishment sources for anybody who wants to see. They've had stories in, you know, big, you know, I think CNN and Huffington Post, things like that have questioned it, saying, is it wise to be doing this? I mean, you know, I think it's pretty easy to answer that question. No, it's not wise to be doing it. But so, as I said, is it really that much of a leap to go from these staged productions with fake blood and crisis actors that we know are happening, admittedly are happening in our schools, to questioning the narratives around the alleged real events? Especially
right.
in these schools.
Yes,
So I don't think it's much of a leap at all, and I'm not going to stop questioning it. And it's interesting as far as Sandy Hook, and I'm writing Hidden History 3, so I'm taking on all these events in Hidden History 3, but along with a lot of other stuff. But I was really amazed when Remington, Which, again, how are you suing the gun manufacturer for that? I mean, that's like suing a car manufacturer for an accident, or, you know, fast food because of obesity. I mean, it opens the door to absurd, you know, lawsuits. But Remington, I had some hope because a while back, and the story was never updated, they were trying to subpoena the birth records, the death records, the school attendance records for these students. Now, that's something that's right out of the Sandy Hook was a hoax theory that so many people on the internet had, because why else would you be requesting those records? And of course, the lawyers for the parents went nuts. This is crazy. And I don't know if they ever got those records because they were never updated, as that happened so often. But just yesterday, Remington was driven into bankruptcy. And the insurance company's representative, Remington, caved, and they settled for $73 million at a suit. There was no mention at all about those records. So I don't know what that means, but I do know that this is – and we've already had Alex Jones, Wolfgang Halbig, who I interviewed once. I don't know where he is now, the poor guy. I hope he's alive. But Jim Fetzer, another old friend of mine. These people have been sued by one of the Sandy Hook parents. So I'm very careful when I talk about it because I don't want to be sued. And I always say all the time, I'm not saying anything definitively. I don't know what happened. But I know there's tons of questions and the narrative makes no sense. And it's never wrong to question things. So, but I think it's horrible precedent that they sued individuals. And now they've sued a gun manufacturer. And that you want to get rid of the Second Amendment, that may be a way to do it. You know, if every time one of these, you know, very questionable events comes up, if they can sue the manufacturer of the alleged gun that was used, just imagine how, you know, maybe other companies like Remington will go bankrupt as well.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at a headline in the Associated Press. I did see that they did settle yesterday. Yeah, it really is outrageous. $73 million. I was just trying to see if there's any information in here about any discovery and if they were able to get any actual information about, if any of this actually happened. Yeah.
Now it's hard because, you know, and I know how much things have changed since I wrote my first nonfiction book, Hidden History, when I was researching that, because it was published in 2014. So it was obviously, you know, probably more than 10 years ago I was first starting to write and research it. But at the time, it was so much easier to do research online because even Google, and I didn't even think of using alternative search engines really then, you could find, like, you know, searching for whatever you're finding for, you're searching for a source for something. You could find it easily. Now, I mean, I have three researchers that really, really help me. They just volunteer. They're just great supporters and they're wonderful there, but they have a better chance at it than I do because I don't know what they do. They have skills, but I go to alternative search engines and everything. And still something like this, where you try to find an update on that story, can't find any update. What did they see? Nothing. And I do know the Remington, Jim Fetzer, wanted to get involved in the suit, and they just, you know, the Remington officials swatted him down. So they obviously wanted nothing to do with him, but what they were asking for is basically the kind of thing he would ask for. So I don't know what the point was of them doing that to begin with, but it's a very strange case. But it sets a horrible precedent there. But again, the people, when you tell them about the real crisis shooter drills that are happening, and of course, that gets into things like 9/11 as well. And that where there was a drill going on at the same time. And you'll find out in all these cases, going back to Gabby Giffords, the Batman Aurora shooting in the Colorado, Sandy Hook, obviously, the Boston bombing. In every one of those cases, there was a drill going on in very close proximity at the same time. And it includes 9/11. But nobody questions these things. I mean, that's really an amazing coincidence, isn't it? So I think there's and I'm not afraid to go there. There's a very thin line there,
right,
between what they call, you know, hoaxes and real things.
Well, and you have to ask yourself, what makes more sense? Does the official narrative of Sandy Hook, for example, make more sense, or the idea that it was, you know, as you say, as you've sort of described, this elaborate drill depicting a mass shooting at a school presented to the public as a real event? Which makes more sense? based on the footage that we've seen, based on the interviews, the quote-unquote eyewitness testimony and some of these victims. Right. I mean, the whole thing from day one was so incredibly suspect.
Yeah.
The medical examiner, what was his name? Oh, Wayne Carver. Yeah, every single person involved in it.
Yeah.
That was Gene Rosen, Robbie Parker.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, who in their right mind could sit there and watch these interviews and find them credible in any way?
Right. But even I try not to go there too much, especially with the parents, because I know that's what gets you sued. So, but you're right. I've seen them and all, and I certainly wonder. But I mean, all you need to know there is that, you know, this and what happened afterwards. You had and we see the same pattern happening going back to Oklahoma City. When the Oklahoma City the rubble was quickly carted away, the defense team couldn't even investigate it for traces of bomb residue, which most of us think was there. And of course, the World Trade Center, you know, they guarded that wreckage with, you know, Rudy Giuliani and all the other people were making sure nobody could get there near Ground Zero. And again, they carted that stuff away to parts unknown. Same thing with the individual things like Flight 77. Flight 93, all those ones, the wreckage, the rubble was carted away to parts unknown. No one got to examine it. But Sandy Hook was the first case. I mean, Columbine High School is still standing and people go there. It's an operational school. Sandy Hook School, once it happened, they put barbed wire fence up all around it. A couple people tried to go up there. I mean, they were guarding that. I mean, nobody could get near the building. And, for the first time in history, they demolished it. So I mean,
suspicious. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, you would demolish. So these things are happening, and people, you know, I don't think it's ever wrong to question, and the mainstream media, as I wrote about and I'm writing about in Hidden History 3. You know, there's a local reporter around here, Andrea McCarran, who I emailed. She's the one that interviewed the school nurse, Sally Cox. And during that interview, you know, apparently the nurse told her that Adam Lanza's mother, Nancy, was a beloved kindergarten teacher at Sandy Hook and how, you know, she'd been there for years and she was beloved as a teacher. Well, obviously that completely destroys the narrative because they subsequently told us that she had no connection to Sandy Hook. Why would the school nurse say that? So I asked Andrea about that, and she says, yeah, I wondered about that at first, but she says, you know, people get confused, you know, typical BS that only an established reporter could believe, that has no, and none of them have any investigative curiosity at all. That's why they get the job. They're told not to investigate anything, unless it's people like us. They'll investigate the skeptics, but they won't investigate anything like that. And then she says there was no conspiracy. And I said, you know, there was no conspiracy should be chiseled on outside every big newspaper's building, because that's a credo they all believe. But that's where you're at, man, is that, you know, these are the people that – now, somebody like her, she should have been the first one investigating Sandy Hook, because firsthand she should – wait a minute. Why is the school nurse telling me that – I mean, how do you make a mistake like that? It's impossible. But – you know, again, same reason they should have been investigating. If you look at Sandy Hook, the original footage, that's what first got me in. No parents, nothing like that. But they were covering it on local news, and the helicopter footage happened, you know, they started covering shortly after the event, alleged event, shows nothing going on. Nothing. You see almost no one kind of people wandering around aimlessly. You don't see any evacuation, nothing. And I'm sorry. It just, you know, you have to explain that. You can say all you want, but, you know, if one picture is worth 1,000 words, one video is worth 1,000,000 words. And, you know, that video, the footage is hard to get now, but I always use that at first. Look at the helicopter footage and tell me if it looks like there was a mass shooting going on there. And again, right. I don't know what that means, but the evidence is what the evidence is.
Yeah, boy, Sandy Hook really was just a crazy, ridiculous scenario. I mean, now that we're talking about it, I'm going back and reflecting on it. I mean, wow, it was, and I remember literally day one seeing the headlines and watching some of the interviews on CNN and Fox News. And I was immediately skeptical.
Yeah.
This just does not add up at all. And who knows exactly what happened? I think the idea that it was a hoax using crisis actors and, you know, like sort of a staged production that was just presented in the media as a real, you know, active shooter, I think makes a lot of sense. And I think it's a totally plausible theory. Well, frankly,
one of the people that canceled me in my family was my nephew. And it happened when my sister kind of, you know, she shouldn't, but she asked my opinion on, you know, and she should know not to do that. But her, you know, her son,
don't
her,
ask Don anything. You're going to get upset.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, my sister's more receptive to it, but he is the biggest Karen at all. And he got so upset when we just started talking about, I think it was whatever school shooting had happened then. It's been a couple months ago. And I was questioning that. I think it was one where they were sending out like an all points bulletin to try to arrest the shooter's parents. And I said, I don't understand. You know, why would they be arrested? It makes no sense. But those are the kind of things I question. But I talked about that, you know, if you look in these events, and I said, for instance, Sandy Hook, and I could see his eyes. I said, you know, there, for whatever it is, whatever it means, and you look in the backgrounds, there are too many, too high a percentage of the parents that had some kind of acting or showbiz, not big, but, you know, local. They were in bands and, you know, they had done some kind of acting. I said that it just, you know, it gets my antenna up. He goes, oh, that's crazy. And they start saying, I don't think your kids are real. You can't prove they're real. And then he just socked off. And that's what you get. You get people that they can't see it. Okay, I've made an observation. Okay, maybe. Is it possible? Sure. But if you go back to, and you know, I write a lot about the Gabby Gifford shooting, which that was the first one that triggered me, my interest in this, when I first started believing, wow, maybe a Truman Show going on there. If you look at that, I mean, that one featured a 59-year-old, very, you know, she was as histrionic as any Sandy Hook witness. She was so over the top, they had to scrub her interviews from the web. But she took the 9-year-old girl who was born on, what's her name? Something Taylor Green, Cynthia Taylor Green, I think it was, that was born on 9/11. She was and so she was the focus of that story. She was born on 9/11 and died, and she was already interested in politics at 9 years old. She was taken to that event by this 59-year-old woman, Susie Heilman, who was not related to her. And as we found out, wasn't even really a neighbor. She lived over 2 miles away. So what, you know, what are you doing letting a 9-year-old, first of all, have a best friend that's 59 that's not related to you? So that was very weird to begin with. And the best friend just happened to have gone to Cornell University at the exact same time when it was one of the centerpieces of MK Ultra, you know, mind control research. So those are the kind of things I look at. And already you could see there people weren't seeing any blood. You could have no pictures. That was the first one where was the cell phone footage? You know, people take pictures of everything now. All the people that went there to meet Gabby Giffords in the Safeway parking lot, Congresswoman, nobody took a picture even of like greeting her before the shooting. No pictures anywhere. And that's just impossible for me to believe. Same thing happened with the Batman Aurora shooting. You know, all these young people are out there, a young crowd seeing a midnight shooting. Midnight show. Nobody took pictures in the aftermath or at this big event to show their friends. Nobody did, apparently. And of course, Sandy Hook's the same thing. You don't see any cell phone footage of the evacuation, anything going at nothing. And that's been the case in all of these shootings. That's what, you know, my antenna really goes off. That it's like, you know, okay, I know how people are with their cell phone cameras now. And that's one thing people ought to ask is, okay, why aren't they taking pictures at these things?
Right. Well, Don, come on. It's just a coincidence. You're thinking too hard about this. Just
yeah, exactly.
Just calm down. Accept what the media is saying. Don't ask any questions. Yeah, no, I know it's crazy. And I mean, what kills me is it doesn't even really take a lot to really question these things. I mean, it's pretty blatant that what they're saying doesn't add up, and there's all sorts of anomalies and problems with the official narrative and. Just weird, like just very weird, bizarre testimony in a lot of these cases that, you know, you should be scratching your head immediately seeing this stuff. So, yeah, it's a very controversial topic, obviously, but one that I think is very important. And the fact that we have a State Department spokesman openly talking about these things and accusing another government of, you know, preparing to engage in these sorts of activities is very, very telling and very revealing.
Well, they just don't happen here. You know, false flags happen everywhere else. They don't happen like going back to 1898 and Remember the Maine. You know, they never had Pearl Harbor. I mean, they don't.
Right, exactly.
Gulf of Tonkin operation. I mean, I tell people about Operation Northwoods. Operation Northwoods was only exposed inadvertently. It came out, I think, accidentally during the release of some of the documents by the AARB after Oliver Stone's JFK movie. And that's where we found out that, you know, in the early 1960s during the Kennedy administration, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the CIA, they wanted to have this absurd production. You talk about a hoax, you know, they basically wanted to stage fake plane crashes and all these fake fatalities and blame them on Cuba. Now, that sounds
it sounds very familiar, exactly. Right? Well, you know, one thing, I remember reading the Operation Northwoods documents, and part of it was talking about the central role that fake victims would play in emotionally drawing in the masses. And that's what you see in all of these events, how emotional the testimony is, and just the overall narrative in general. It really targets the masses on such a deep, like sort of base psychological, emotional level. And, you know, I think that's what prevents anybody or, you know, most people anyways, from really questioning these things. They just, they hear this testimony, they hear the, you know, the overall narrative, and it's too horrific for them to even think critically about.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And that's, again, I think we just, you know, it's people just don't want to go there, and you try to, you know, you talk about the other false flags. You talk about the Operation Northwoods, which was, you know, very Sandy Hookish, to say the least. And people just, they just give you the blank look. And that's the problem, is unless it's talked about on the television stations they watch, or their stupid celebrities they worship talk about it, maybe, you know, then they would open their minds up. But, you know, that's why, you know, people like us can't be given, you know, huge platforms, you know, because if we were on television, any of us really that has knowledge of this, it'd be the number one rated show on TV very quickly.
Right.
People would flock to it, and they can't have that, because it would make, you know, that's why Tucker Carlson's the number one show, because he gives you as close as you're going to get on television. And, you know, it's no accident that he has the most viewers, because people are thirsty for it. And even if they don't believe it, they, you know, the conspiratorial talk, I mean, because I have a few people like that don't believe anything I say, but they love to listen to me anyhow. They think it's interesting. And at least they're open-minded in that way. And there's a lot of people out there that would start watching just, and then eventually they would, you know, they'd start seeing what you were saying. They'd look around and, well, that's true. I see that happening. You know, they're right. But they can't have that. And that's why they keep the competition, as they say, non-existent as it is in any other part of the system.
Right. All right, Don. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I appreciate it. Real quick, you want to plug?
My pleasure.
Yeah, can you plug your websites real quick before we get out of here?
Yeah, well, again, to go to Substack if you want to look at my brother, about my article and all my other writings, a lot of my other, DonaldJeffries.media, my blog, which goes way back, and people can find things about Sandy Hook and all kinds of stuff going back several years, is DonaldJeffries.news. My latest book is On Borrowed Fame, Money, Mystery, and Corruptions in the Entertainment World, forwarded by the great John Barber of Real People fame. People can, you know, see that I write about more than politics. It's an interesting look, I think, at the entertainment industry. But I'm easy to find. The Donald Jeffries Show is every Wednesday on Ocelli.com. And I Protest is back, and I am live streaming on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. It also airs live on Rockfin every Friday at 5 p.m. So people can catch that there and interact if they want.
Very good. And of course, we can find your articles in American Free Press as well.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Every issue.
And I would encourage people to subscribe to the newspaper. Check out AmericanFreePress.net for all those details. All right, Don. Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it. We'll do this again in the near future.
Okay. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.